Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. On behalf of AstraZeneca and the Cancer Enterprise Leadership Team, welcome to this investors meeting and welcome to ESMO. My name is Mandar Majoubi. I'm the head of Global Portfolio Strategy for Oncology. I have the privilege and the pleasure this evening to chair the meeting and to kick off our session. I will be handing over very quickly and shortly to my colleagues, Rachel Humphrey, who leads the late-stage development team for immunotherapy, and Susan Galbraith, who is the head of the early-stage clinical development for AstraZeneca. Before we start, I wanted to very quickly remind you where we're coming from. And I remember that a year ago at Amsterdam, we didn't have this such opportunity to meet with you. We came to this meeting with very modest presence. We had a handful number of abstracts, and as a matter of example, we presented data for 11 patients on PD-L1 and 60 patients, I think, for 9291. Was the start of momentum that you've seen over the last couple of months, and actually 4 months ago in Chicago at the ASCO meeting, we had the pleasure to meet with you and to update you on, first of all, our strategy on how to get back to the leadership position in this field, but also share with you the progress of our pipeline, and in particular, the six NMEs that are in late stage with 13 projects in phase three. Today, we are at ESMO again, and we are extremely excited because, as I said, the momentum keeps growing. You will see from the presentation the progress we've made, in particular in developing 9291, AZD9291, which is our anti-EGFR inhibitors targeting the T79M mutation positive in non-small cell lung cancer, but also the progress we've made in developing our antibody against PD-L1, MEDI4736. We decided to focus the session this evening on these two assets. So with no further delay, I will hand over to Rachel Humphrey, who will update us on the progress for PD-L1. And then Susan will share the update on 9291. We'll take question at the end of the session. There will be question here, but also question online. I wanted also to let you know that the slides are already available on the our website, the Investor Relations website, so you will find all the information available whenever you get online. Thank you.
Good evening. Okay, I'm going to focus on the immuno-oncology program, specifically the PD-L1 project and the combination with tremelimumab. First, we'll start with the monotherapy PD-L1 project. So just a reminder about the anti-PD-L1 antibody, MEDI4736. There are two key messages here. The first, that this PD-L1 inhibitor does not bind to PD-L2. It is strictly a PD-L1 inhibitor. And the second is immunogenicity. There isn't any to speak of. There were two patients out of 196 at the 10 mg per kg dose that showed transient drug antibodies. They did not impact PK, and so therefore it's not an active issue at the 10 mg per kg dose. Another important thing, you heard that last year at ESMO we presented 11 patients worth of data. At this meeting we're presenting 408 patients in the expansion of our phase one, but as of this week we've enrolled over 600 patients, and that number is climbing rapidly in both monotherapy and combination. So study 1108 was a phase 1-2 dose escalation study with expansion into multiple tumor types. There was a dose escalation portion that went up to 15 milligrams per kilogram Q3 weeks. The 10 milligram per kilogram Q2 weeks was chosen as the dose for further exploration because it hit the target extremely well and was 100-fold above the dose where we began to see activity. The expansion program with over 500 patients treated as of September was conducted in the cancer types you see there, There are 8 additional cancer types added to these 8, and we won't be talking more about that later. Suffice it to say that the expansion into a greater number of cancer types has been initiated. Okay, here's safety of 4736 monotherapy. A handful of messages here. No evidence of colitis of any sort, no high-grade pneumonitis, and no drug-related deaths. I'll draw your attention down below to the pneumonitis. There were 5 pneumonitis events of all grades. 4 of them were incidentally found on X-ray. The 5th was, and they were asymptomatic. The 5th was a symptomatic patient who was progressing in the lung. And otherwise, there are no other reported events of note. This walks you through the safety profile in all the cancer types for which we have data at this time. And you can see that the pattern is the same across the cancer types. There's no meaningful difference. Okay. Let's talk now about the anti-PD-L1 monotherapy across all the tumor types. This is a classic spaghetti plot. The patients who have experienced any amount of shrinkage or stabilization is colored in green, and there are gray lines there. I hope you can see them for those patients that have progressed, but you can see that the majority have experienced some level of benefit as defined by shrinkage or response. The study stops the dosing at 52 weeks. So you can see that the proportion of patients who've been followed out to as long as 90 weeks from the start of treatment have experienced post-discontinuation activity. There's one patient who had a clear progression at 60 weeks. This is a patient who was treated at 1 mg/kg and who's being retreated now at higher doses, and follow-up will be available in the coming months. Moving over to the table on the right, of the total number of responders with a follow-up, a median follow-up of 29 weeks, 92% of those patients remain in remission. And this is the subset of patients who experienced a pure RECIST response. That is, they didn't have any new lesions. Their index lesions were dropping. Naturally, you can see from the spider plot that there are additional patients whose index lesions decreased and continue to decrease, and some of those have had new lesions, and yet they're, as you've seen before in this class, there continues to be tumor suppression. As before, the enrichment of responses by PD-L1 status, that trend is continuing. Here, the PD-L1 positive population with more patients treated over time, the objective response rate is 22%, and the response in the PD-L1 negatives, and this is across all tumor types, is 5%. And the disease control rate is also trending in the direction of improvement in the PD-L1 positive group. But suffice it to say, these numbers are still small, but the continued trend is interesting and consistent with what others have seen. So now we'll look at non-small cell lung cancer in specifically. Here you can see, again, evidence of encouraging activity and a trend in favor of separation by PD-L1 positivity. The majority of patients in the waterfall plot on the left in blue have some level of tumor shrinkage, and although it may not project the vast majority of the patients, their index lesions are below the cutoff for progression. The PD-L1 negative trend shows a clear activity, but not as robust. Moving over to the table, with a median follow-up of 24 weeks, the total number of true responders by RECIST that remain in remission as of the cutoff date in mid-August is 88%. And again, the trend in favor of the PD-L1 positive holds up in the numbers as well. I'm going to point out that the objective response rate in lung cancer for the PD-L1 negative patients is 10% for the monotherapy. Hang on to that number because we're going to refer to it again later. Okay, this puts the PD-L1 expression story in the context of other agents in the class. With more patients on, the pembrolizumab number of 23% in the PD-L1 positive population aligns with MEDI 4736. The Nevo data presented at ASCO shows no apparent difference by PD-L1 status, and there's been no additional data from Roche than those presented at ASCO, where the denominator was 13 and the objective response rate observed in the PD-L1 positive population was 46%. Now, there are a number of key features here I think are worth emphasizing. The first is that each company has its own assay. That's important because the cutoffs are different, the proportion of patients who are positive may be different, and in the case of Roche, they're examining both the infiltrating lymphocytes as well as the tumor, and so the nature of their result may be meaningfully different under those circumstances. Of course, these aren't randomized study data with similar or the same assay, so the absence of randomization makes it hard to interpret. Within the confidence intervals of these data shown here as well as earlier at ASCO, these numbers are consistent, and as you put more patients on, you see changes in the numbers, but the basic message is the same. The PD-L1 positive patients appear to be doing better. But we'd say that the most important message here is that MEDI 4736 is clearly active in lung cancer, and putting it together with tremelimumab in combination offers us an opportunity to potentially increase the number of patients who are benefiting and really drive some value for patients. Okay. So here's the safety profile in head and neck cancer. It's consistent with what we saw in lung cancer. I'll highlight here the number of grade 3-4 events, although I went through that slide very quickly before. The story is the same in the lung cancer and the other tumor types. And as you can see, the number of grade 3-4 events is one patient with fatigue, which is 2% out of the 61 that we treated in the phase 1 study 1108. Once again, there are no evidence of colitis, no high-grade pneumonitis, and no drug-related deaths. Very nice safety profile. Okay, here's the waterfall plot and the spider plot in head and neck cancer. The spider plot distinguishes PD-L1 positives from negatives. I think if we move over to the waterfall plot, you'll get a better feel for that. But just sticking with the spider plot for just a moment, there are patients who have experienced objective responses, stable disease. The clinical benefit group as measured by stability and shrinkage of the index lesions is in the majority of the patients here. And if you move to the right, you can see again a trend in favor of response by PD-L1 status, where though there are fewer patients who are PD-L1 negative in this series, the proportion of patients whose index lesions had a best response below the line of shrinkage appears to be better. And I'll show you some numbers here. So I'm going to draw your attention to the middle line, where the objective response rate was 24%. Out of a denominator of 17 patients we know are positive, and the disease control rate at 12 weeks was 35%. And I'm going to preempt any questions about the pembrolizumab data that you saw this morning to help you frame these data in the context of those. So here we're looking at PD-L1 positive patients across the PD-L1 positive subset. It's not separated by high or low. It's the full group of patients. And so if we're going to be comparing or looking at one in the context of the other, we would say that putting all the PD-L1 positive patients together, the best apples-to-apples comparison would be the data presented at ASCO, where the overall response rate in PD-L1 positive patients only for pembrolizumab was 19%. Now, we're examining additional opportunities to further enrich the population. We have a robust translational program, but at this point, these are the data we're reporting with our PD-L1 assay. Again, you can see the objective response rate in PD-L1 negative patients is a single patient out of 33. So again, there's a trend in favor of PD-L1 positivity. Oh, and one other thing. The ongoing responses here, this is 6 out of 6 patients followed for a median follow-up of 31 weeks, or close to 8 months, is all of the six patients remain in remission. And again, this is pure RECIST response by RECIST. Okay, now we'll focus on the combination. I'll show you an update of the data. These were presented also in a poster during this meeting. This is an update on the escalation pattern. A few messages here. Again, on the right, we put the Nivo-Ipi combination where the maximum tolerated dose was 1 and 3. They were also using 3 and 1, and they were unable to escalate higher than that. At this point, we are still escalating. We've been through dose levels that include dose level 5, which is full dose of tremelimumab, the dose we're using in the phase 2 and 3 studies. That's 10 milligrams per kilogram Q4 weeks. We are currently dosing at 20 milligrams per kilogram Q4 weeks of the PD-L1, which is comparable to the dose intensity of the current monotherapy dose, which is 10 milligrams per kilogram Q2 weeks. I'll show you the safety. These data are notable for the following. I'm going to turn your attention to the highlighted column, where there were 3 patients out of the 24 treated to date that experienced adverse events leading to discontinuation. In the 5A cohort, there is an asterisk next to that 0. That's a DLT that occurred after the data cutoff. So that's our first authentic DLT, and that cohort has been expanded and additional data are pending. But taking the number of events within the time frame as per the data cutoff, the rate of events leading to discontinuation is 13%. And if you look at the column right next to it, the drug-related grade 3-4 events is 6 out of 24, or 25%. We note again the grade 5 event of a patient who died from complications of myasthenia in one of the early dose levels. There have been no additional drug-related deaths. Okay, here's an update of the Kaplan-Meier, of the spider plot and the waterfall plot. Again, this was in the poster, but let me walk you through some basic features of this. To date, there are 18 patients who are efficacy evaluable based upon how long they've been on study or how long it's been since they were entered onto the study. The efficacy picture on the left continues to show a population of patients who either have tumor regression with response by RECIST or tumor stability. The waterfall on the right shows you a picture by dose level, and you can see there are objective responses or tumor shrinkage in patients at all but the lowest dose level, which is in red. The table at the bottom highlights the RECIST response, which is 5 out of 18 patients for an objective response rate of 28%, and this is in all dose levels. Recall that we're still escalating. And the patients who achieve stable disease by RECIST is 5 out of 18 patients for a total of 10 patients out of 18 who experienced RECIST-based objective responses or stable disease control. So this picture helps to frame the subset of patients who are PD-L1 negative. And the reason to look at this population is because many groups, including our own, are looking at PD-L1 positive patients for the monotherapy. So the medical need in the PD-L1 negative population remains important. And go back to that 10% I pointed out, which is the yellow column on the left. Out of the 74 patients treated with 4736 monotherapy, 7 of them achieved objective response by RECIST. And of the 10 patients that we know are PD-L1 negative, out of the 18 whose efficacy criteria we understand, that was 3 out of 10 responses, or 30%. Now, the numbers are small, and definitive conclusions cannot be reached. So take these data with a grain of salt. But we would view this pattern as interesting and encouraging. Adding the objective response to the stable disease, we have 7 out of 10 of the patients who are PD-L1 negative achieving a pure RECIST objective response or stable disease compared to 42% for the monotherapy picture. So I would say we're exactly where we want to be, given the number of patients that we've treated to date in the combination, with a good safety profile, a competitive safety profile, with escalation continuing, and evidence of synergy that's consistent with a trend in favor of synergy that's consistent with preclinical models, as well as data presented by others who have a combination in this class. Okay, so we'd say that the anti-PD-L1 antibody 4736 has an encouraging safety profile, consistent across the cancer types, active in multiple tumor types, although I'm not showing you these data here. At a poster here at ESMO, there were data presented for gastric and pancreas and HCC. Again, encouraging signals. These are consistent response rates, consistent array of signals with the rest of the PD class, and as you saw, ongoing responses in greater than 90% of patients with a median follow-up of at least 6 months across the board. The combination has a manageable safety profile, generally manageable, with dose escalation continuing, although we didn't talk about it at any length. The patients who experienced AEs leading to discontinuation were generally reversible with steroids or discontinuation. There are early signs of tumor activity that we'd call promising, and the subset in PD-L1 negative patients where the monotherapy doesn't look to be very active helps to reinforce the potential for additivity or synergy. Now, I'm going to show you in the last few slides the pivotal studies that were either have already started or are about to start in lung cancer and head and neck cancer. It's worth noting that we have a robust registrational program that's underway in these two cancer types. So first we'll talk about the plan for speed. The anti-PD-L1 monotherapy is being tested in two clinical studies we've talked about already at ASCO. The first is the Atlantic study. It's a two-cohort, single-arm, uncontrolled phase two study with the monotherapy divided into two cohorts by EGFR or ALK status. Patients are treated to PD, and overall response rate is the primary endpoint. We've been enrolling since the early part of the year, and we expect to show data next year with the potential filing in 2016. The second is the Arctic study, which asks two questions. One is PD-L1 positive monotherapy in the PD-L1 positive subset, and the combination in the PD-L1 negative subset. This study is ready to start and will be initiated once the final refined dose for the combination is identified, which we expect to happen sometime by the end of this year or early next year at the latest. This is a study with dual endpoints of PFS and overall survival, and we expect our primary data readout in 17. We're also looking for differentiated indications where we have the potential for first mover advantage, and there are two worth noting. The one on the bottom we reported at ASCO, it's in stage 3 unresectable patients, and we recently announced that we are going to conduct a study in the adjuvant space. This is with PD-L1 4736 monotherapy in unselected patients. PD-L1, it's all comers with a primary endpoint of PD-L1 positivity in the subset of PD-L1 positive patients, stage 1B to 3A. We are conducting this study with the National Cancer Institute of Canada. The head and neck program has a single-arm phase 2 study as well. That study has initiated enrollment already. And again, here we think we'll have data to report in 2015. There's a study in the middle there that offers opportunity for contribution of component. though I didn't say so specifically. The Arctic study in lung cancer also offers contribution of component opportunity, and therefore we're essentially testing the combination of 4736 plus tremelimumab, both in lung cancer and in head and neck cancer, with the potential of understanding how the efficacy and safety compares to that of each of the components. Phase 3 randomized study is also set to open as soon as the dose is available, and this is a study that looks at the monotherapy agent in PD-L1 positives, negative as well for additional contribution data, the combination in all comers against the standard of care. So we have 3 studies, 1 in lung cancer and 2 in head and neck cancer, that is examining the combination. All 3 are set to start and will be initiated either at the end of this year or early next year when the dose is available. 2 slides on OX40. As you may have heard, we have 2 OX40 molecules in the clinic. The first has been there for quite a while, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. And the other, a fusion protein, initiated phase 1 a few weeks ago. But first, a word about the mechanism of action. This is a target that has multiple impacts on the immune system, inducing T-cell activation and migration, and a variety of things that I won't read on the slide. But it's an important pathway. OX40 antibody is an agonist. And in preclinical models, which I won't show you today, combinations with both CTLA-4 and PD-L1 look extremely promising and certainly merit additional combination work as well as the monotherapy work. This is the last slide coming up. We have a murine OX40. It's been in the clinic for quite a while, has single agent activity, and we are initiating a study that, or have initiated a study that combines this agent with both PD-L1, CTLA-4, and rituximab, respectively. The PD-L1 arm has already begun enrolling, so we have patients who are receiving that combination now, and the others will enroll as time goes on. Those cohorts are open. The humanized anti-OX40 is a multimeric. The study is a monotherapy dose escalation study, and again, that study is initiated dosing. There's a second humanized OX40 molecule with different features that allow us, with all 3 constructs, to ask meaningful questions about how they may differ. They're all OX40 targeted molecules, but what we would say is we have a robust pipeline that enables us to get at the right one and pick the best of the 3 in order to proceed. The first study, first patient is expected to be enrolled into that last phase 1 sometime in the next few months. So in fact, this is the last slide, which you don't have to read, it's small, but it highlights the fact that we have 21 combination studies underway or about to start. And I'm about to start in the very near term. There are 20 cancer types represented by these studies. Additional combination studies are also in the planning works, but these are the ones that are either ongoing or very shortly to start and worth attention now. So our commitment to immuno-oncology is clearly very robust. Since last ESMO, we've initiated registrational programs in 2 cancers and have a wide variety of both combination studies as well as multiple cancer types we are exploring. So with that, I turn the podium over to Susan Galbraith, who'll tell you more about 9291.
Thank you, Rachel. Welcome, everybody. So I'm happy to talk to you about the updates that we've got on our mutant selective EGFR inhibitor, AZD9291. Let me just start by reminding you about the design of this molecule. Based on the understanding that we've developed of the mechanisms that develop for resistance to currently available EGFR inhibitors, we know that about 60% of them develop a second mutation, the T790M mutation. And with the addition of that mutation, it changes the binding affinity for ATP. So it means that drugs and reversible EGFR inhibitors like Iressa get displaced from the binding pocket. So what we've done is design a molecule that binds irreversibly, and so overcomes that change in ATP binding affinity. And it binds potently to the sensitizing, to receptors that have the sensitizing mutation and also have the double mutant with a sensitizing mutation and the T790M. And it also does so with a 30-fold margin to the wild type or normal receptor. And that's important because clinically other irreversible inhibitors, drugs like afatinib and dacomitinib, are limited by the incidence of high-grade rash and diarrhea that's seen. And so they're not able to achieve exposures in the clinic that enable them to inhibit T790M. Another important feature of the design of the molecule that I mentioned when I spoke to you at ASCO is that we designed it specifically to have a chemical scaffold that did not inhibit the insulin receptor or insulin-like growth factor receptor, which some scaffolds do, because we did not want dose escalation to be limited by observing high blood glucose or hyperglycemia. Okay, so those were the key design features. Since ASCO, we can now update you again. Like Rachel, I'm happy to announce we've got over 600 patients now treated on the 9291 program, a program that only dosed its first patient in human in March of 2013. So the rapidity of accrual really speaks to the unmet need in these patients that have T790M mutations. The data that I'll go into in a bit more detail shows that in those patients, we've got a confirmed overall response rate of 70% now in patients treated at the dose we're taking forward into pivotal trials, the 80 milligram once daily dose. We're also able to update you on the progression-free survival. So the median duration of response for those patients is now 8.2 months, and it leads us to give us an initial estimate based on immature progression-free survival data of 9.6 months. And I say it's immature, and I'll go into that in a bit more detail when I show you the PFS plot. The data is only based on 30% of patients having had a progression event, which means that 70% of patients, fortunately, have not yet progressed. So we expect that that data and that estimate of median progression-free survival will continue to mature. We're also presented data now in the initial cohort of patients treated in the first line. Remember I said that this drug was designed to also hit the sensitizing mutations. And I'll go through some of those data. So we're seeing a response rate in line with expectations of 63% in the first line EGFR mutant patients. The preclinical data that we have, I'll talk about a little bit, shows that we've got potential to have sustained efficacy beyond what you see with the currently available EGFR inhibitors that are used in first line. And again, the data set that we've got confirms in a very large number of patients now the reduced wild type toxicity based on that design element that I described. So let me take you through the data in a little bit more detail. Okay. First of all, let me just show you the patient population that were enrolled in the expansion cohorts of the AURA study. This is a data set of 222 patients. And again, you can see that it's split 60% Asian, 37% Caucasian. And there's a good distribution of patients that have had either one, two, or three or more prior EGFR inhibitors, which again, 62% of patients having immediate prior EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and 38% having had some intervening therapy, typically chemotherapy. What we feel this represents is that we've got experience across multiple centres in multiple countries and a distribution of patient demographics that will enable us to have generalisation of the benefit-risk profile across the patient populations that we intend to seek for initial indications. This slide shows you the updated waterfall plot showing the best percentage change from baseline in the target lesions. Again, I'll draw your attention to the 70% confirmed overall response rate in the patients at the 80 milligram cohort, and also to the fact we've seen efficacy at the lowest dose cohort, which was 20 milligrams, and up to the 240 milligram dose cohort, which was the highest dose that we tested in this study. The longest response is now ongoing for over 11 months, and as I said, the median duration of response so far is 8.2 months. So this slide shows you the progression-free survival curve, again, with the confidence intervals, which I hope you can see labelled around it. So as I said, the estimate currently of the median progression-free survival is 9.6 months. And again, I'll make the point that I made at ASCO, that you really need a reasonable number of patients at risk at each of the points along a progression-free survival curve to be confident about the data. That's why we've projected the confidence intervals. And I really think that point is up to around 8 months in this plot. So we expect it to further mature. Again, if you look at the 95% confidence interval around that median PFS, you can see that the lower limit of that 95% confidence interval is 8.3 months, and the upper limit is not yet reached. So we expect with increased maturity of data that this number may change and could further increase. Now, I just want to talk about the safety data. Again, what we're presenting here is safety data across all the dose cohorts from 20 milligrams to 240 milligrams, and I've split it out for the patients with an adverse event. This is not just drug-related adverse events. These are all adverse events. And it's split out by grade, with those at grade 3 highlighted in the right-hand column under each dose level. So again, the first point to take away is that the incidence of grade 3 adverse events is low across all dose levels. If you look at the 80 milligram dose cohort, which is highlighted in the middle there, you can see again that we have 0 or 1% grade 3 adverse events at that dose level. So let's go through the adverse events of particular interest. For diarrhea and rash, we've got 30 patients and 29 patients that have had any grade of those particular events. I just point out that of the 29 patients with rash, 28 of them were grade 1. And grade 1 rash can be as minimal as a couple of acneiform spots. That would still count as a grade 1 rash. Again, I'll point out that all of the patients on this study have had prior experience of EGFR inhibitors and are well familiar with the adverse events that they get from those. What we're hearing, to put together with these quantitative data, the qualitative assessment from the investigators is that the burden that patients feel from these adverse events is substantially different, both qualitatively and quantitatively, from what currently available EGFR inhibitors provide. We turn to the adverse events of interest at the bottom. Again, I pointed out that we have not seen grade 3 hyperglycemia. That was based on the design element of the molecule. We do not see a concern with QT prolongation. In the 620 patients that form the denominator of all the patients treated so far, we have seen 13 pneumonitis-like events for an overall rate around 2%. The majority of those events are of low grade, but we have had one grade 5 pneumonitis event in a Japanese patient. So this is an event that is seen as a background rate in patients with lung cancer. It's seen with all EGFR inhibitors that have been described, and the rates that we are seeing are in line with expectations about EGFR inhibitors in this disease. And I'm going to turn to some of the data that I've referred to in the first line. On the left-hand side of this slide is the waterfall plot from the first-line patient cohort. And again, I remind you that the current estimate of the overall response rate in this patient population is 63%, which is in line with expectations. And the overall disease control rate is 95%. There are some patients in this cohort treated at 80 milligrams in blue and others at 160 milligrams in yellow. So again, I think just to remind you, the preclinical data that we have for the first-line models that mimic the first-line setting, you will see regression with both drugs like Iressa and drugs like 9291. Where 9291 differs from Iressa in those preclinical models is in the depth and durability of response that you see. And to get a sense of whether that has translated through to the clinic in terms of durability of these responses and prolonged progression-free survival in first line, we're going to need more patients and more data. And we will happily update you on that at ASCO next year. I also want to draw attention to some anecdotal examples of activity that we've seen in patients that have brain metastases. Relapse through brain metastases is an increasing problem for patients with EGFR-mutated lung cancer. And many of the drugs that are currently available don't have good penetrance across the blood-brain barrier. 9291, based on our preclinical assessment, does penetrate brain, and the estimates from those preclinical experiments is that we modelled the 80 milligram dose, we expect to get good exposure in the brain. So we have anecdotes at the moment of activity in patients with brain metastasis, which is encouraging, and we'll continue to expand our experience in this group of patients that represent an area of high unmet medical need. So on the basis of the preclinical data, the robust confirmed response rates in second line and the excellent tolerability profile that we have seen, we are planning to initiate a phase 3 trial in the first line setting of patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, randomising 9291 at the 80 milligram dose level to the first generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor dealer's choice of erlotinib or gefitinib. So the primary endpoint of this study is progression-free survival. There are secondary endpoints of overall survival, response rate, quality of life. We anticipate enrolling the first patients into this study later this year, and the primary data readout in 2017. I spoke at ASCO also about understanding how this drug may be combined. The excellent safety profile that we've seen so far and activity, we believe, forms a great backbone on which to look for combinations with a range of other agents that might help to overcome resistance mechanisms. And we did publish data at the AACR earlier this year showing that we have looked for mechanisms of resistance that occur to 9291 and seen that we get MEK pathway activation in some preclinical models. On the basis of these data, we have now initiated enrollment into a study which is looking at the combination of 9291 plus our MEK inhibitor, selumetinib, 9291 plus our MET inhibitor, vorolitinib, which has shown activity in MET-amplified patients, and, with PD-L1 in this study. The first subject was dosed in the third quarter in all three combinations. And again, I look forward to updating you with data, potentially at ASCO next year, on the results of these studies. Now I want just to turn to innovation that's happening in the diagnostic area as well. And I want to draw attention to data that we released as a press release late last week, where we announced that the CHMP, European Regulatory Authority, provided a positive opinion for the inclusion of a testing by circulating tumour DNA in the ERESA label. This is important because not every patient is able to have a tumour biopsy, which is the current means of diagnosing and detecting the sensitising mutations in EGFR. So what that means is some patients don't know that they've got an EGFR mutation and wouldn't necessarily get the optimal therapy for their tumour. The IFOM data, which is shown on the left-hand side of this slide, show that the response rate for patients that have EGFR mutation detected by the circulating tumour DNA test is numerically very similar to the response rate that you see based on the tumour-based biopsy. And this provides an option for those patients who can't have an initial tumour biopsy. The availability of circulating tumour DNA tests and the improved technology around those tests is also leading us to examine this technology in the 9291 programme. There was a poster presented earlier at this meeting detailing the activity that we've seen in 192 patients in the AURA programme that have got circulating tumour DNA data. And again, you see a similar pattern, which is that the response rate for patients that have T790M mutation detected by circulating tumour DNA appears very similar to the response rate of those patients that have that mutation detected by the tumour biopsy. So we'll continue to look at this, not just as a potential predictive marker, but also as a tool for monitoring response over time and quantitating that response. So just to summarise, we've continued to have very rapid progress with extremely rapid accrual to the programmes with 9291. We've seen an unprecedented confirmed response rate of 70% and disease control rate of 95% in patients with the T790M mutations treated at the 80 milligram dose level. The progression-free survival we've seen in those patients we believe is encouraging, but is still immature and will continue to mature. We've seen activity in patients that have brain metastasis, and we've seen encouraging activity in the first-line treatment of patients with sensitizing mutations in the epidermal growth factor receptor, with preclinical data that supports the decision to move forward into a pivotal trial here. The tolerability profile we've seen overall is consistent with what we reported at ASCO and remains encouraging. And we continue to push forward in terms of the speed of the development of the program, initiating that first-line trial later this year. So with that, I'm going to close here and be happy to take any questions that you may have. Thank you very much. Sorry.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Rachel. So open the floor for a question. We'll start with the question in the room here, and from time to time I will look at the screen for the online question.
Thank you. This is Alexandra Halper from UBS. Three questions, please. Firstly, on the dose escalation of Meditremi, so you would expect that you can just straight read across from the head and neck, from the non-small cell lung cancer into the head and neck. I'm just asking because it looks like at least Merck is doing different dose finding in different tumor types. Second question, what do you really expect to learn from the murine OX40 PD-L1 combination? I understand you can only give that as a single administration. So if you don't see anything, it doesn't tell you whether it works or not. If you do see something, is there any dosing information you can derive? Just really to understand better why you're doing this. I'm interested. I understand it's interesting, but and then third question. This is on 9291. In the phase one study, will you allow patients to cross over when they progress?
In the phase three.
So in the phase three, yeah. Sorry, in the first line.
Okay.
So actually, maybe we start with the first question, then Peter enters the OX40 question, and then back to Susan for the 9291.
That's great. Okay, so the question was, are we going to use the non-small cell lung cancer dose in head and neck cancer? And on the basis of what would we do that? At this point, we would say that the combination safety and efficacy is a strong enough signal that doing the definitive study in other cancer types using the same dose and schedule makes some sense. We have some additional data that's being generated in head and neck cancer also, so we will have data from both cancer types when we make our choice.
Could the OX40?
Thank you. Thank you for your question on OX40. So the study that we currently have ongoing, the murine OX40 plus PD-L1, is really to look at defining the biology of the combination a bit better. Your comment on a single dose is accurate. But again, in this pathway, from an agonist point of view, we don't really know what will happen. How often do you need to dose? So we're using it to inform the other molecules around dosing and schedule, but also to evaluate from a translational point of view what happens in the body in combination when you give an agonist plus a checkpoint blockade molecule.
But it's just worth adding to the second part of your question, which is what would we do if we didn't see anything in that combination? And the answer is proceed.
Susan, you're
okay. And I'll just say that Flavia Borellini, who leads the 991 program, may want to comment, but there isn't a plan for crossover in the first line study. Flavia?
Yes. At the moment, we don't plan crossover, but we are in active discussion with health authorities, and it will also depend on what is the status of our data set for second line.
So you don't think it's going to be necessary in order to establish it as front line? Because the idea is that the PFS is longer.
People want to probably see that the PFS is longer for both the first and the second line therapy, given that.
Yes, so the primary endpoint of the phase three study is PFS. And at the moment, we're not building a crossover in the protocol, but we are discussing this with health authorities.
So we take another question from the floor here and then online.
Thank you. James Gordon from JP Morgan. It was two questions. One was about the head and neck and the comparison with the Merck Pembro data. I didn't quite follow. Is the possibility that your assay is overstating, or relative to the Merck data, is overstating the proportion that are high or low? Because when I looked at the data, their data was a higher response rate in the high and the lows, and I think they had a lower proportion that were low, but maybe they had a lower proportion that was low patients, but they still look better on that comparison. And then also just a question on assays. Could the assay be an issue for the combo data that we saw for the PD-L low patients, which was a surprisingly good result, or surprisingly high response rate?
The activity in PD-L1 negative. So.
Yeah. So let me answer the first one, then I may need a repeat of the second one. I'm not sure I completely understand it. So the question was raised: the response rate looks higher in both the high and the low for Merck. We would simply say that averaged across both with a different assay, the results are comparable, particularly since the data that they showed at ASCO had an overall response rate that was the same. But we note that using a different assay with different approaches to cutoffs, looking at the patient population in head and neck cancer, the results differ.
Yeah.
But I believe
so, Mohammed, do you want to comment on the activity in PD-L1 negative for the combo?
Sure. So I can make a comment on the lung. I think we're fairly confident about our PD-L1 assay in lung. As you saw in Rachel's presentation for monotherapy, the cutoff that we've established, the response rate in positive and negative, compares relatively favorably with the other assays and the other competitor data. So I think based on that, the combo data, which is in lung, we stand behind at least the initial preliminary data that we're seeing activity in the negatives.
Thank you. Let's take a question from online. And I see Tim Anderson. Do you want to ask your question?
Yes, thank you. On slide 17, you talk about dose escalation continuing with 4736 and Tremi. Does that, just to clarify, does that continued escalation also include taking Tremi above 3 mg per kg, or is it really just 4736 that you're dosing higher above the 20 mg per kg dose shown? And then a second question is, I know that, you know, the total human data you have so far with the combo of those two products, it's still fairly limited, but Rachel, a few months ago, you made some pretty strong claims saying you felt Tremi would be a safer and better drug versus ipilimumab. And I'm wondering, you know, your updated confidence in making that claim now that you have more data.
Yeah, thanks very much for those questions. So first, a detail on how we're dose escalating the combination. And the answer is we're varying both doses. We're varying both the tremelimumab dose in both directions, 1, 3, 10, as well as the PD-L1 dose. There are a variety of dose levels that are being enrolled, and we'll certainly have more to report at the next meeting. The question you're asking about my confidence in tremelimumab as a combination partner, I'll simply point to the available data, which is at a full dose of tremelimumab, 10 milligrams per kilogram, Q4 weeks, we were able to dose beyond it. It seems to us that the potential that tremelimumab is a better combination partner holds. And we'll leave it there. Obviously, the study is still escalating, and we'll know more in the coming months.
Thank you, Rachel. Take another question here.
Thank you. It's Louisa Hector from Exane BNP Paribas. I've got some questions on the combination again and the dosing, because this came up a lot from commentators, both sort of querying the dosing. Do you go high, low? Do you compromise one dose with the other? And I think we can see some of what you're doing there. But there are also a lot of questions on sequencing, alternating, and perhaps having another induction phase or a reinduction later on. So just wondered where your thinking is on that side of the dosing. And we also saw, looking across the PD-1, PD-L1 studies, particularly in lung cancer, we're seeing the smokers as the responders, and then in head and neck, the HPV negatives as the responders. So just wondered if you can comment on that and what you think is happening there. And on 9291, the dose that you chose, the 80 mg, so across all the doses, you were getting good efficacy. This seemed to be the highest efficacy. Was there anything else that made you pick that dose? You've mentioned the brain mets as well. So just how you got to that dose of the full range that you tested. Thank you.
Okay, so there are two questions. One is about the schedule for the combination. So first of all, in our phase one, as you can see, we're going up and down for both agents and exploring varying ratios for precisely the reason you suggest. We also have an additional study that looks at a different relative schedule between the two medicines. But what we would say is the ability to administer them together at the same time with good safety offers the best opportunity for continuous inhibition of both of them at the same time. The next question was smokers and HPV negative. I'll start with the HPV negative. We do have some data there, and the objective response rate in the HPV negatives does appear to, the HPV negative, the response rate is higher there. But with the numbers being small, it's hard to draw conclusions, but that pattern persists. You want to
So are the HPV negatives all PD-L1 positive?
Right. So the subset of PD-L1 positive by HPV, those data are not available, but we're examining them now. And in terms of smokers, in our hands, we don't have a large enough sample size to make to draw a conclusion, but the general trend is in the same direction as you mentioned.
Thank you.
Just to answer your question about the selection of the 80 milligram dose, I'd just point out that the AURA phase one study has a much richer data set to enable dose selection than most oncology drugs give you the ability to do, where you typically have, you know, 3+3 dose escalation. So we looked across all of those dose levels. And obviously what we wanted to do, we knew that in the absence of a different adverse event limiting dose escalation, right? So in other words, if your dose escalation is limited, for example, by hyperglycemia or by the maximum absorbable dose, right, it's possible that then you wouldn't get up to a dose level where you're starting to see wild-type toxicity. We knew, based on our preclinical profile, that if we were able to dose escalate up enough at some point, you start to overcome that that margin, that 30-fold margin. And again, we have a 12-fold dose escalation, which is unusual. So what we've done is look at that incidence of rash and diarrhea by dose level, and also the responses that we're seeing. And so the choice of 80 milligrams was based on an assessment across both the safety and the efficacy of where we think is the optimal place. You know, the data that we've seen so far, you know, confirms that choice. We are getting, I can't tell you that 70% is statistically different from the dose level below, but it's a trend of optimizing the response rate and minimizing the adverse event rate.
Before we move to the next question, Mohamed Dar, who leads the phase one combination program for PD-L1, wanted to add an additional comment on the head and neck data and the HPV. Status.
Perhaps I had misunderstood your concern, but with regards to the Merck data, just two key points to point to raise. Our head and neck study, we enrolled everyone. There was no pre-screening, so there was no low, high, or negative. Every patient got enrolled in our head and neck cohort, whereas my understanding is with the Merck data, there was pre-screening, so they enrolled people with some level of PD-L1 expression, and then they subset it. So that's an important distinction. So I think the point we're trying to make is if you take their study population before you subset so that they have any level of PD-L1 expression, their response rate's around 19%. And if you look at somewhat comparable population, which is any PD-L1 positivity on our assay, it's around 24%. So it's in the ballpark.
Okay.
Susan, just a quick sort of two questions on the 80 milligram dose for 9291. When you look at that dose, several of the patients progressed. You went to 30 patients, and I think a few of them progressed. But you didn't necessarily see that in the other doses. So I'm just trying to understand, was there anything unique about some of the patients that progressed? And then second, when you look at, give us a little bit of a sense, as you think about PFS over time, kind of where can it go, and how important is inhibiting IGF, or is there any suggestion that binding to IGF is actually therapeutically beneficial?
Okay, sure. So in terms of the progression, I mean, I think just point out generally, you know, patients with lung cancer have thousands of mutations in the lung cancer cells. So it's actually almost remarkable that you get these level of response rates because of one oncogenic driver. And what that does, what we understand, is basically what you're doing is you're getting a clonal selection pressure put onto the tumor. So those clones that have some resistance mechanism that provides them with a survival advantage will eventually grow out, right? And that's one of the reasons why we want to do a combination with PD-L1, amongst other things, to help overcome that, because, you know, as we've seen with other potent and specific inhibitors of oncogenic drivers, resistance will come through. So it's not a surprise that you see progression events. I think the, just put it into context, the current available therapies for patients that have T790M mutations is really only chemotherapy. And you expect to see progression of a median progression-free survival of around 3 to 4 months in that patient population. So to currently see the levels that we're currently seeing is unprecedented. Right? So I think it's very encouraging. About the where that upper limit might go, that's just speculation. We have to wait for the data to mature, and we're happy to do that. You know, but it's encouraging is what I would say at this point. And then the final point about IGFR, again, there are a number of agents that have tested inhibition of IGF and IGF receptor in the clinic. None have yet shown sustained clinical benefit in the settings. And I suspect that while there are individual cell lines and in vivo models that have some resistance to EGFR inhibitor driven through the insulin-like growth factor receptor, that doesn't necessarily represent the most common resistance mechanisms that are visible in the clinic. And so, again, I haven't seen any substantive data sets to support that mechanism would drive enhanced progression-free survival. Time will tell.
So one more question before we take a question on the phone.
Okay. Thanks. Seamus Fernandez from Leerink. Just a couple of quick questions on the TREMI plus PD-L1 combination. Can you, first off, update us on how many patients do you anticipate to have dosed in total before making your decision to move into phase 3? And can you just give us a little bit of an update on, you know, you have a very different dosing schedule than what we've seen from Bristol-Myers Squibb, you know, and there were obviously decisions made on your part. So can you help us better understand what drove those decisions? And you do dose again after the fact, so the plan is to kind of redose with Ipi as a combination 3 months later. Do you have any evidence that redosing actually is helpful? Any patients that have been sort of late responders with a kind of retreatment with the combination? Thanks.
No problem at all. So first of all, as of today, we have close to 30 patients enrolled. And depending on the number of dose levels that we'll be enrolling, the number could go up. And I'll turn to Mohammed so he can make a closer estimate based upon the clinical study. With regard to redosing, so right now the tremelimumab is given Q4 weeks indefinitely, and so is the PD-L1. So it's not a matter of redosing, it's continuous dosing for the combination as written. I know there are other groups that may be dosing with Ipi once and not redosing again. This is a different approach. The other question you asked was about dosing schedule. So yes, right now both drugs are given Q4 weeks. The monotherapy dose for the PD-L1 agent is Q2 weeks, and we'll be looking at that as well to round out the story. I don't know if you want to add anything, Mohammed, about the phase 1.
Sure. The additional comment I would make with regards to size is that the way the study is designed, we can actually expand multiple cohorts. So the data that Rachel presented shows 3 patients, because that's the standard 3+3. But now that we're beginning to get a feel for where the safety and the efficacy sort of have a positive benefit, we can expand them in parallel. So that's what we're currently doing.
And just to be complete, we made the decision to go into phase 3, and now we are just selecting the dose level, and we are pleased with the level where we are, because when you look at the dose we use in monotherapy for both agents, we are already at an optimal dose. So I think we are on track to pick the dose in the next few months. But the decision to go into phase three was made. Mohammed, you want to comment on the phase one program you have?
So, I mean, from an early drug development perspective, that there's always a balance between having some understanding of the safety and efficacy of a given dose. So, the traditional approach is that between 6 to 10 patients, 20 patients is usually sufficient to start phase two programs. In this case, we're making a conscious decision that based on the totality of the data, we can skip phase two and go to phase three. So it's essentially a risk-benefit decision. And you know, you can keep waiting and generating more data, but we think we probably have sufficient data to make that call.
Thank you. Let's go on the phone now. And Jeff Holford, up to you to ask your question, please.
Great. Thanks for taking my question. So it's back to more questions around the combination. Is it actually that you think tremelimumab is the better combination partner? Or perhaps do you think there may be also some advantages of your PD-L1 approach versus the PD-1 approach? And I just ask this because it could be important in subsequent combination programs with other molecules. Can you just tell us what you think about that side of the question? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much. So we would agree that both tremelimumab and PD-L1 have potential advantages as combination partners. As I said at ASCO, tremelimumab doesn't have off-target activity laid next to ipilimumab side by side in melanoma. The anticancer activity, the efficacy and safety are the same. But it may be that having a CTLA-4 inhibitor that focuses on CTLA-4 may, without collateral activity, increase combinability without changing the efficacy profile. The PD-L1 inhibitor, as I said in the beginning of the talk, doesn't inhibit PD-L2. All available data suggests that PD-L1 drives the anti-cancer activity. There aren't data to date that help to reinforce that PD-L2 plays the same role, but PD-L2 does impact lung inflammation and has activity in autoimmune models, murine autoimmune models, that raise the potential that having PD-L2 inhibition may have a liability, again, potentially in combination from a safety perspective, and may explain why PD-1 inhibitors have high-grade pneumonitis, and we haven't seen that at all with 4736.
But just to follow up on that a bit more, if I can, have you actually tried preclinically PD-1 with tremelimumab and seen a potentially different safety profile than PD-L1 in preclinical?
So one of the challenges with preclinical models is that the mice don't experience immune-related events. We can only say that the PD-L1 combinations in murine models with CTLA-4 combinations look extremely promising, and there's no good way to distinguish the clinical antibodies in the animal models.
Thank you, Rachel. So let's go back to the room here. We have more than 60-plus callers listening, so please feel free to ask your question. We'll take them, but let's get back to the room here.
Yes. Hi, Nicolas Grangelin, Morgan Stanley. Two questions, please. The first one is on the PD-L1 is head and neck. What kind of PFS improvement are you targeting versus other existing therapies? I mean, what would you consider as clinically significant? And the second one is about 9291. I appreciate it's still very early days, but could you elaborate on the response rates you have seen for first-line EGFR-mutated patients? I mean, how many patients are we talking about? And is there any more details you can give us? Thank you.
Absolutely. You start with the 9291 first, Susan?
Sure. I can get you the exact figure because it was on the poster that was presented. I apologize, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but I think it's around 50 patients or something like that have been treated in first line. But there's only a subset of those that were evaluable for response. So if you look at the number of bars on that waterfall plot, I think that's 20 to 30 patients worth of data. So I'd just say again that the overall response rate is in the range that you would expect. Our experience in the second line was the the very first cut and initial estimates of response rate in the second line were in the 50 percent range, and they've matured with time. Most patients see their responses at the first data cut, but some gradually increase, and you would expect to see the same pattern in the first line, so not everybody's at the same follow-up point. So it's in line with what you would expect. Again, I just point out that I don't necessarily expect the overall response rate in first line to be the most discriminatory feature versus currently available EGFR inhibitors. I think that's going to be about the depth and durability of response, and for that we're going to need longer follow-up than we currently have. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So let me start with the clinical study in head and neck. First of all, we're not prepared at this time to give fine details about the clinical study. Suffice it to say that the second study we mentioned was a classic contribution of component, designed and sized accordingly, and that the phase 3 study is sized and designed for a realistic endpoint against the standard of care.
Back to the room. Another question? Okay, go ahead.
Mary at Amemitz Prime Avenue. Couple of questions, please. The first one's a very general question on PD-L1. There's lots of discussion about response rates by PD-L1 status, but what is actually the evidence to date that response rates are highly correlated with PFS or OS, and that that correlation is the same for all agents, or that PD-L1 status actually influences PFS or OS? And the second question is on 9291. I was just wondering, do you have any conclusions from the IMPRESS study that you can use to de-risk 9291? And I realize it's a completely different setting, but I was just really a bit disconcerted by the presentation just now, which just doesn't seem to explain the paradoxical results at all. If anything, I mean, it seemed to be explained by the differences in subsequent therapy, which seems to be something that could happen in any trial. So I was just wondering, you know, how, if you can reassure us on that point. Thank you.
Sure.
So I'll take the PD-L1 question first. I don't think any organization, any team, has sufficient data to state for sure that the relationship between PD-L1 positive and negative will end up being meaningful. However, all the data is consistent for the most part across the class, and in terms of likelihood of technical success in the near term, picking your patient population where your comparison with your standard of care, whatever your control is most likely to win, that's a good bet. So, but the other thing that's worth emphasizing is our combination in the PD-L1 negative population seeks to cover all comers, and at some point that assay may not be meaningful for the combination.
Okay, so let's just go to the IMPRESS data. So again, I think I'd point out that this is an important question that scientists, physicians, investigators had about whether in a disease setting of EGFR-mutated lung cancer, whether the continuation of an EGFR inhibitor beyond the point of progression in combination with chemotherapy would add additional benefit. I think the answer's been robustly, that question's been robustly answered, which the answer is no, it doesn't. And I think what that represents from my perspective is just representing the high unmet medical need that these patients have, and the need for therapies like 9291 to come and target the specific mechanisms that are driving that resistance. Now, T790M is one of those mechanisms, relevant in about 60% of those patients. It's not the only mechanism of resistance, and I think it's important that we understand that and then direct therapy to the to that specific mechanism, which is one of the reasons why we're interested in the combination studies that might address additional mechanisms of resistance that are actually prevalent in the relevant patient populations, not just observed in preclinical models.
Thank you, Susan. One more question.
Thank you. Peter Lawson from Mizuho. Just a couple of questions for Susan. When do we get the next meaningful readout for 9291? And then when do we get the next readout for the first line readout? You mentioned 2017, but I guess we get preliminary between now and then.
Okay, so the data that we currently have on the AURA study, which is single-arm study, and the AURA-2 study, which is in a very similar patient population, will continue to mature, and we can expect to see updates of that. The randomized study, head-to-head versus second-line chemotherapy, has started. But we're expecting, because that's randomized, that you will then wait until that study is complete and the data mature before that will read out. Again, the randomized study versus first-line EGFR inhibitors, you would also expect, we'll need to wait until that those data mature and that study is complete. But the single-arm studies that we currently have and the combination studies and the expansions in patients with brain metastases, you can expect updates on those studies at next year's conferences, typically at ASCO. Flavio, I don't know if you want to add anything to what I have said. Okay.
Thank you. Let's go to the phone, and may I ask Steve Scala to ask his question? Steve, please.
Yes, thank you. It seems that you aren't seeing improved efficacy with the combination of PD-L1 plus tremelimumab in PD-L1 positive patients versus the PD-L1 alone. Both show overall response rates in the mid-20s. Based on this data, should we conclude that the combination likely only will be useful in PD-L1 negative patients?
Excellent.
Thanks
question.
For the question. So of the data that we have right now for the 18 patients who are evaluable for efficacy, we only know of one patient who's confirmed PD-L1 positive. So in fact, the comparison, cross-study comparison, between the combo study and the monotherapy study has not formally been conducted, so we can't draw any conclusions at all.
Yeah. I wanted to add just one thing based on the data we have so far. As you know, almost 60%, eventually 70% of the patients are PD-L1 negative, and clearly the response rate we've seen across the board is rather low, ranging between 5 and 10%, and that's where the unmet medical need is, and I think the combination data seems promising. But for the PD-L1 positive, clearly there are other combinations that could potentially increase the efficacy and prolong the duration of this response, and that's what we are exploring in our multiple phase 1b program that Rachel showed you.
If the question was also comparing the monotherapy PD-L1 positive against the combo PD-L1 negative, that's probably an imperfect comparison. At this point, it may be true that within the PD-L1 positive population, the combo also does better. We simply don't know.
Okay. Back to the question. We have a couple more before.
I think it's Keyur Parekh from Goldman Sachs. And apologies for going back to the head and neck data. But as I look at the data presented by Merck on Pembro today, it looks like Pembro has a broadly similar response rate between HPV positive and HPV negative, between 19 and 20%. Whereas for the, and that's an N of 56, kind of a newer trial, you got an N of 53, and we've got an HPV positive response rate of 4%. Is there a particular reason why the PD-L1 versus the PD-1 may be driving the differential response rate in HPV positive?
So I'll start by answering that the assays are different, so that may be one reason, but I wonder if Mohammed would want to add anything about the HPV positive and negative in terms of our numbers and the potential response.
So the numbers that we have, not all, about a third of the patients that were enrolled on our head and neck cohort, we don't have HPV status data. But you're correct that the data that we do have does seem to suggest that we have more activity in negatives versus positives. But I would say the numbers are small, and so I wouldn't draw any firm conclusions. But there does appear to be differences across the two study populations. But there are two caveats. The numbers are small, one, and number two, a third of our patients, we don't have the HPV status. So it's just on the available that it looks like it favors negatives.
Thank you.
Hold on
one second.
Just from 9 to 9-1 on the 80 milligram dose. My understanding is you moved from kind of a capsule to a tablet kind of somewhere during the course of this study. Is that having any differential effect from a side effect profile perspective, be it diarrhea or rash? Thank you.
So we've done a comparability sort of pilot study of the capsule versus the tablet, we don't see any PK differences, and we're seeing and experiencing the same adverse event profile and efficacy with the two different formulations. It's a well-behaved drug from a pharmaceutical perspective. The curves overlap, and actually they're within the 80 to 125 comparability criteria. So we're very comfortable with the formulation that we have.
Okay, thank you. Are there more? So we have one question in the back. Yeah.
Yes, this is Terence McManus from Credit Suisse. Back to the combo data again, I'm afraid. So the contribution from Tremi is we're expected to believe that's because there was an enhanced efficacy in the PD-L1 negative patients. I just want to confirm that versus the monotherapy trial, I just want to confirm whether it's exactly the same assay that was used to assign whether those were negative patients. And also, of those limited number of patients, were there any characteristics that you could share which may have enhanced their ability to respond? For example, can we just confirm whether they were all smokers, or is there any other attribute that you could share on those patients?
Mohammed can answer that question. He knows the study.
Yeah.
So the numbers, I mean, we're talking about 18 patients, so the eligibility criteria was not dramatically different from our phase one monotherapy study, so I would say that the patient characteristics are not that different. Can you repeat your first question that you had?
Yes.
Oh, right. So the assay is identical between the phase one monotherapy and this combination. The only difference is that the vast majority of patients in the monotherapy study, we mandated a fresh biopsy or a biopsy within a year. Since this is still in the dose escalation phase compared to the monotherapy, which is an expansion, we just relied on archival. So that's an important difference.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, one more question here on the phone. Thank you.
Can I ask about the scientific rationale for using the PD-L1s in the hematological cancers rather than the solid tumors that we see everyone chasing after? Please.
So there's no reason to believe that any cancer wouldn't be sensitive to an immunotherapy. In fact, there are multiple examples where heme cancers are treated with bone marrow transplant or other settings which are formally designed in some way to replace the patient's own bone marrow or immune system with one that may be more active against the tumor. We know from clinical studies with other immunotherapies that lymphoma is very active, that leukemias are potentially targets, and therefore the heme malignancies are solid opportunities as much as the solid tumors.
Yeah. Peter, I know heme is your passion, so maybe you want to give also your perspective on this question.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. I think if you look at the etiology of the solid and hematological diseases, what you'll see is that a lot of these assays are based on PD-L1 positivity as a premise that it is driven by an ongoing immune response. Whereas in hematological malignancies, these molecules are natively expressed as part of controlling the actual immune response, especially when you think of things like T cells and myeloids or myeloid histologies or lymphomas. So it is not a far stretch to think that the underlying sequelae of the biology driven by heme has a huge component which is driven by the PD-1, PD-L1 pathway. And so what is not discussed here, but what you can find on clinicaltrials.gov, is that AstraZeneca MedImmune is in the process of evaluating what complete receptor blockade looks like, also in solid tumors with plans on heme as well. And that is looking at an anti-PD-1 and an anti-PD-L1 for complete disruption of that pathway.
Thank you, Peter. Do we have additional questions in the room? Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, James Gordon from JP Morgan. It was just a question on, based on the data we've seen at ASCO, do you see PD-L1 and VEGF, anti-angiogenesis, as a promising approach?
So the Avastin data that were presented today were mixed. I think the jury is still out. From a hypothetical perspective, VEGF has an immune effect, but I would say that to date, the data are not sufficiently encouraging to definitively state it's a good combination.
Thank you.
Thank you. Since we do not have other question on the phone, so let's take question here. Yes.
Susan, just Yaron Werber from Citi. One more question relating to filing AZD9291. It sounds like from one of your last slide decks, you're thinking that potentially filing in Q1 next year is possible. Just give us a little bit of a sense. What's the gating element to that?
So again, I said at ASCO, and I'll say again now that the base case filing that we lent out was in the second half of 2015. Given the breakthrough designation that we've got with the US FDA, we think there's going to be opportunities to accelerate that. And, we're as keen as anybody to get this drug to patients as quickly as possible. Obviously, in the discussions that we have with regulatory authorities, there are, there's pros and cons of the different pieces of the data set. But the good news is that we've completed enrollment to the single-arm expansions of the AURA-1 and the AURA-2 studies, actually slightly ahead of schedule. Enrollment's going quickly. We're comfortable with where we're sitting at the moment.
Thank you, Susan. No more questions. We are getting to the end of the meeting. So the last one, maybe, before we close.
Thank you. Just the Merck data, I think it was one of the discussants said that PD-L2 could play a role in head and neck cancer. Do you see that mechanistically that would make sense, that there could be a reason that it would be advantageous to target PD-L2 as well if you're treating head and neck?
Well, I think at the end of the day, the jury's out. We can simply say that, again, reinforcing what Mohammed said before, which is to say that the Pembro data was generated exclusively in an enriched population that was already PD-L1 positive up front, exploring more apples-to-apples comparisons makes it difficult to state emphatically that the agents are meaningfully different. I would say the jury's out there, but the contribution of PD-L2 potentially to the safety profile, particularly in the lung, appears to be an important factor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Rachel, sorry. So we get into the end of this meeting. I want to thank you for your participation and for the insightful question. I hope we could give you a sense of the progress that we are making and answer, I hope, most of the question. I would like to thank Susan and Rachel, who took most of the work here, and of course the entire team who helped prepare for this meeting. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening and a wonderful stay in Madrid.